Democracy is Power. Rebuilding Unions from the Bottom Up, Chapter 5. Elections. Voting is a core procedure for union democracy. First, some votes on contract ratification, for example, allow the membership to make a key decision directly. Second, elections have an impact through their potential rather than their actual use. The fact that an election will take place is a kind of backstop. To the extent leaders believe that members can vote them out of office, they will try to listen to and deliver for the members. Third, an election campaign can draw many members, both active ones who formulate issues and campaign, and passive ones who are exposed to the campaign and then vote, into greater activity. The election season creates opportunities for more involvement and knowledge so that all kinds of choices, voting included, are more informed and meaningful. At the same time, elections by themselves don't ensure democracy, and there are limitations on their usefulness. Elections are a snapshot of leadership-membership relations and priorities at the time of the vote. Since the union needs to respond to rapidly changing circumstances, interchange between leaders and members, and development of members into new leaders has to go on between elections as well. Elections also tend to put a premium on certain kinds of activities and personalities, the good talkers, the simple solutions, and elections take resources. The purpose of unions is not to have elections, but to give members power in dealing with the boss. Elections are a crucial tool for giving the members power, but their use must be balanced against the time, money, and energy they require. In this chapter, we deal only with officer elections. See Chapter 4 for discussion of contract ratification votes. What are we choosing? Elections typically take the form of choosing individuals for individual offices. We elect a local president, vice president, and executive board members. As voters, we often see our task as choosing the most qualified person for the job. Sometimes we're admonished to vote for the platform, not the personality. Either of these is too simple a way to view elections. We can't just pick the most qualified candidate because qualifications matter little if the candidate doesn't carry out the right policies once in office. On the other hand, qualifications do matter. The most best platform is useless if officers, once elected, can't get the platform carried through. Elections are a chance to weigh potential leaders' personal attributes together with their viewpoints. At the same time, voters are often presented with a team, not just a group of individuals who make up the slate. How do they work together? Who are the people they tend to work with most closely? The most militant stewards or the skilled trades clique, for example? In a local where different forces are actively contending about the future of the union, a vote for officers is a vote about the policy and priorities of the local. The debate may be over militancy versus partnership with employers. It could be over a choice between the servicing model and redefining the union based on rank-and-file activism. Most likely, the choice is not so clear-cut. It gets mixed up with personalities and the candidate's past actions. These are part of elections, too. Which candidate has the character needed when the going gets tough or in face of temptation? Which ones will have the flexibility to respond when new issues come up? We hold old leaders accountable for their records. But elections are not a one-way process where potential leaders present frozen positions and records and members simply choose among them. Leaders, including opinion leaders not in office, also shape members' sense of what's possible. Campaign rhetoric about militancy, for example, will tend to make members consider striking to be a real possibility next contract around. On the other hand, expectations are often kept low. Vote for incumbent President Smith for more of the same, or for challenger candidate Jones for more of the same, only better. This is one reason for low turnout. Individuals versus teams. Slate voting. Slates may not be important in electing a steward. There we are mainly concerned with the individual's performance. Does she write grievances well, stand up to the boss, organize the members? Because of the nature of the job, we can evaluate the candidates firsthand. But this kind of individual evaluation makes less sense for the further away the candidate is from your direct experience. How do you decide between two candidates you've never met for treasurer of the local or the international? What counts is not the kind of job officers do individually, but how well they do as a group. Slates help voters make decisions based on proposals for the union's direction, not who's made the most friends. Slates mean those in the leadership team take collective responsibility for the slate's platform and for the performance of any individual member of the slate. Slates also help balance representation in the leadership. As candidates put their lists together, they'll naturally want to include people from various parts of the union, racial and ethnic groups, job classifications, work locations, to help gain votes from all those parts. Of course, members should also have the right to ignore the slate, to pick and choose among the candidates regardless of slate designation. But ballots that list slates, even allowing a single check mark to serve as a vote for a full slate, help clarify what the election is about. Uncontested elections. A leader of the International Alliance of Theatrical and Stage Employees declared in its IA bulletin after their 1998 convention that, quote, "This international has gone without an election and demonstrates to the world that this union once and for all is united," unquote. One member saw the lack of an election differently. He commented on the internet, quote, "The message from a convention without votes, without debate, without contending factions, without dissenting views, without opposing candidates, is a message from a top-down organization with a powerless, uninvolved membership," unquote. By itself, this uncontested election doesn't prove one view or the other. Democracy requires not a certain number of elections, but a lack of barriers for members to put themselves forward as leaders. The fact that any given election is not contested may simply be a sign that the democratic process has been at work throughout the year, that new members are moving into leadership roles, elected or not, and the leaders are responsive to members. Or an uncontested election may be a sign that members believe that leaders can't be replaced through voting, which becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Election procedures. Procedures for running elections should not only ensure an honest election and a fair campaign, they should also help the campaigners to focus on the direction of the union rather than personalities, pose real choices, and draw members into activity. An honest election means it should be easy to vote without intimidation, without or retribution, with polling places conveniently located and open for reasonable periods. A fair campaign. Oh, wait, here's a box. How to get an honest union election. It's a 64-page booklet by longtime democracy activist Herman Benson, available from the Association for Union Democracy. It gives useful tips on the dangers of stolen elections, some safeguards, notes on the law, and a sample test of election rules. Contact Association for Union Democracy. A fair campaign. Fairness requires that members do not have to jump high hurdles to be eligible to run, such as a requirement for dozens of nominators. A bylaw that candidates must have attended most union meetings rules out nearly all members and has been ruled illegal by the Department of Labor. Beyond that, the ideal of a fair contest implies something like a level playing field, when in most cases there's no way to make conditions truly equal. Factors that can be put can put mountains on the playing field are incumbency, finances, and employer involvement. All these often work together against rank-and-file reform campaigns. The power of incumbency. In the worst cases, selected candidates are given the advantage of incumbency before they are ever elected. In the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, for example, and in some other unions as well, a retiring international officer typically picks his successor, in effect, by leaving before the end of his term. On retiring, he effectively chooses his replacement, who can then run as the incumbent. Caucuses in some locals follow the same practice. This does, quote, smooth the transition, unquote, as its defenders claim, if by smoothing we mean creating the sense that the results are already fixed and discouraging opposition. This practice is simply contempt for the election process and democracy. Incumbents' advantages include access to members for campaigning. First, incumbents have the list of members and where they work. Incumbents may not legally use the membership list for campaigning unless it's available to all candidates, but it's usually difficult to prove whether and how an incumbent used her access to the list to aid her campaign. In private sector unions, all candidates have the right to have the union mail their campaign literature at the candidate's expense to all members or to subsets of members. Federal law for private sector unions also gives any member the right to view all current labor contracts at the local office. Teamster reformers have used this right to gain a list of work sites for their locals. Again, this is information easily available to incumbents in the course of their union work. The most valuable lists can be developed only through face-to-face campaigning. These are the lists that map the local, listing not only names but who's in contact with whom and who the natural leaders are. Any challenger needs to make such a map for a serious campaign. Incumbents also have an enormous advantage in campaigning at the worksite. Employers can exclude union candidates from their property as long as they do it equally. Incumbents or their appointees can assert that they're there on union business. The law allows them to campaign while on the clock if it's, quote, incidental, unquote, to performing union business, and they certainly will. Control over events. By picking which grievances or which contract issues to pursue, incumbents can often determine the most visible issues. If they organize a group grievance on a health and safety issue shortly before the election, then challengers are more likely to be asked, what would you do differently on health and safety? Incumbents may also be able to set the date of an election to their advantage, say before or after a contract negotiation. Regular exposure to members. Incumbents achieve name recognition simply through meetings, union publications, and handling union business. This advantage can be partly compensated for by allowing challengers to publish campaign material in union newsletters and to give a campaign talk at a union meeting, and in the use of slate designations on ballots, Staff and appointees as campaigners. Incumbents can use appointments to both full-time and committee positions to staff a campaign organization. Again, appointees campaigning must be off the clock or incidental to their union work to be legal. Handing out favors. Incumbents can reward supporters with immediate benefits, appointments to offices, lost time authorization to attend conferences, special handling of problems and grievances. Given these natural advantages of incumbency, fair election procedures should include some steps to balance the advantages out, as described in the box, without weakening the regular functioning of the union or the elected officers. Suggested bylaws for democratic elections. Here are some ideas for bylaws to help ensure candidates' right and ability to campaign among the members. 1. Recording secretary will provide all nominated candidates a list of all work sites represented by this local. 2. Candidates may post election materials on union bulletin boards. 3. The local will include statements of all candidates and/or slates in union newspapers. 4. Ballots will include candidates' slate affiliation if designated. Before the election, the local will sponsor a candidates forum with a moderator agreeable to all candidates. 6. The union will make all reasonable attempts to see that all candidates have access to non-work areas of work sites for campaigning. Of course, incumbency has potential disadvantages too. Incumbents are responsible for results. where incumbents can talk convincingly about union successes on organizing and building members' power, for instance. Having a record is a big plus. But when things are not going well, decline of the industry, technological change, members may take it out on their leaders, even if the problems are due to external conditions. The members reasonably respond to the slogan, "It's time for a change," and hope that a different leadership can get results. Not uncommon for reformers who win office and actually do a decent job to be defeated in the next election. In fact, incumbencies is an advantage primarily because it offers the opportunity to take advantage of other factors that tilt the playing field: employer involvement and unequal financing. Financing. Union elections, unlike elections for public office, are mostly won through person-to-person contact, conversations among coworkers. Still, in a local large enough to have full-time officers, election campaigns take money, and the incumbents usually have more. Besides the personal cost of taking time off work to cost to contact members, the big expenses for an election campaign are usually printing and possibly mailing literature and hosting any events like a barbecue or spaghetti dinner. Full-time union officers generally have more money to spend on election campaigns than rank-and-file challengers because they're usually substantially higher paid than the members. In many cases, they also have more high-paid friends and allies, fellow officers of the local, staff reps, officers of nearby locals, and often officers and staff of the international, especially in unions like the Teamsters, UFCW, or UAW, where there's a union-wide reform organization and a set of officers trying to stop it. In large locals, there may be a dozen or so appointees, usually business reps, who owe their jobs to the incumbent officers and will be expected to help their re-election bid. To level the playing field and make finances less a factor, unions should print uncensored statements from candidates in a pre-election newsletter that goes to all members. SEIU Local 509, whose members are Massachusetts state workers, gives candidates a limit on how many words they may write for the pre-election edition of the newsletter. If they go over, the newsletter simply cuts them off in mid-sentence if need be. The Teamsters International magazine provides a designated amount of space for each candidate. Candidates may run any text, graphics, or photo they choose, and slates may pool their space. However it's done, the point is to make a base level of campaign literature and distribution available to all candidates at no cost. Election rules could also limit the size of donations to an amount that's affordable to most members. This may be hard to enforce, but will tend to limit the effects of widely different personal incomes, which is the goal. Some unions, notably the steelworkers and service employees, have rules on campaign fundraising whose main effect is to widen any difference between the higher paid and lower paid candidates. In today's world, this difference mostly occurs between incumbents and rank and filers. These unions say they don't want outside influence on elections and therefore prohibit donations from anyone but current members. Employers are already prohibited by law from donating, so they're not affected by this kind of rule. The effect is on donations from non-members who are not in management. A no outside donations rule doesn't protect an election integrity, but it does hinder democracy by placing a disproportionate burden on insurgent candidates. They're the ones most likely to need donations from non-members to try to close the funding gap. A few dollars from their sister-in-law, raffle tickets sold at the corner bar, or donations from reformers in another union. Incumbents who are able, as so many are, to put hundreds of or thousands of dollars at a time into their war chest, do not need to cast so wide a net. For instance, in larger locals, incumbents might spend $10,000 on a re-election campaign. With several business reps and officers putting in $1,000 each, that's all the fundraising the incumbents need to do. Meanwhile, rank and filers will have to pull together hundreds of much smaller contributions to build a budget even half that size. It's doable, but more difficult, and will tend to involve some supporters beyond the membership. since they help level the playing field, outside contributions to election campaigns should be allowed, except, of course, from employers or vendors. The difficulties faced by rank-and-file candidates today mean that candidates should also be allowed to accept donated legal help to enforce campaign rights. Certainly, laws against employer contributions should be strictly enforced. That's easier said than done. Truly crooked campaigners will find ways to subvert any rules. A cumbersome attempt at prevention, like requiring that names and addresses of each contributor be reported, no matter how small the amount, as required of Teamster International candidates for the 1998 rerun election, falls more heavily on rank-and-file challengers. A requirement for listing small contributions puts dissidents at risk of retribution, giving an advantage to those with access to accounting and other bureaucratic resources. Makes all sides more prone to technical violations and still doesn't guarantee honest data. While watching out for the employer's contributions is necessary, the best defense is education before and during the campaign period to maximize the number of members who can recognize illegal interference and understand how it hurts the union. If too many mailings of too glossy literature raises eyebrows and costs votes, and if an explicit employer endorsement would torpedo a campaign, the union gets some protections against employer influence without having to impede legitimate fundraising. Employer involvement. Most of the power often ascribed to incumbencies is actually incumbents' ability to make deals with employers. Many of the opportunities to provide favors to members are really deals brokered with management. A union officer, if he chooses to, can usually get a member's special consideration on a grievance or extra time off. This can be done by focusing the power of the union, or it can be done by an exchange of favors with a manager. The latter is frequently easier, although the leader now owes the manager. Employers get involved in union elections in a variety of other ways. They may be suddenly willing to settle large grievances or offer a perk right before election time. As in HERE Local 6 in New York, when officers announced a new prescription benefit just before an unusual contested election. Or they may threaten to close the plant or lay off a shift if the wrong candidate wins, as General Motors and Ford did at two plants in Michigan. In both cases, the incumbent's opponents in the union were the main purveyors of management's threats. Employers have been known to make it easy for certain members, supporters of the incumbents, to get time off to vote, shutting down certain assembly lines at one auto factory, or, for instance, and even providing transportation to and from the local union hall in some Teamster locals. The worst employer involvement is harassment and firing of candidates and other campaigners. The problem is both widespread and difficult to prove. In the first ever direct election of Teamsters' top officers, dozens of protests were lodged by rank-and-file members who were disciplined or fired, apparently. Apparently for their campaign activity, nearly all of them supporters of reformer Ron Kerry. Employer involvement in elections is illegal, but it happens in a context. Management's ongoing influence in the union through those who are either literally corrupt or just too cozy with the boss. So stopping such involvement is as much a matter of changing the culture of the union as it is a matter of enforcing the law. Mechanics of voting and voter turnout. Voter turnout by itself tells us nothing about the democratic quality of an election. Totalitarian one-party states can produce turnouts in the high 90% range. There's a penalty for not voting. Mob-dominated urban machines achieve high turnouts. A hotly contested election may produce a big vote, but if the choices are meaningless, the turnout is meaningless. There's nothing democratic about a greater number of voters choosing between Tweedledum and Tweedledee. What we want is the greatest number of people making as well-informed and meaningful choice as possible. Resources. How many polling places are needed? Should we use voting machines or paper ballots? How long should the polls be open? How many members of the election committee should be paid lost time to monitor the election? If the union had unlimited resources, the answers might be easy, but union resources are precious, so there are no easy answers to these questions. Where elections are hotly contested, or there is any suspicion of dishonest behavior, then the union needs to spend more on voting machines and monitoring. It's not just the fact that also the appearance of election fairness that must be preserved. But at all other times, these expenses are a waste of money that could be used for activities that increase solidarity through the long period between elections. Voting locations and mail ballots. Should elections take place at the workplace, perhaps in the cafeteria, in the company parking lot using tents or trailers, at the local hall through the mail? Where possible, where the union hall is a comfortable place for most members, elections should take place there. That's where it's easiest to build an atmosphere that voting is about what's best for us all. But when the union hall is an intimidating place for many members, then mail balloting is better. Turnout is usually highest at the worksite because of convenience. That's a plus. But the disadvantages of voting at the workplace far outweigh the advantages. Elections held at work make management's presence and influence stronger. An incumbent can use her influence to get a supervisor to release the whole department to go vote. The atmosphere is company and company power. The company may well intervene in any disputes, like campaigning too near the polls, that arise at polling sites. Although parking lots are technically company property, management is less likely to intervene there, and make more likely to allow the union to establish whatever kind of atmosphere it wants. A downside is that parking lot voting stations tend to encourage tailgate parties and thus a cliquish atmosphere. Voting at the union hall has several advantages. Most important, the union atmosphere can be most easily established there. The act of voting itself helps familiarize people with getting to and using the hall. The disadvantage is that turnout will definitely be lower than at the workplace. Also, geography is rarely neutral, particularly in racially segregated areas. The location of the hall could influence the racial makeup of the voters. The hall, Union Hall itself, may not be a neutral place. The hall is more or less the territory of the incumbents, a fact that can influence which members feel comfortable going there. In some unions, if you're not known to be a supporter of the incumbents, showing up to vote can feel like, or actually be, getting marked for retribution. For this reason, and in an uphill battle against voter apathy in the union, Teamster reformers usually work for local elections by mail. TDU considered it a step forward when in 1992 the International recommended mail ballot elections in its revised model bylaws for locals. TDU members have sometimes applied to the International to require mail balloting where a history of intimidation is evident. True, mail ballots can be more difficult to monitor than a small number of walk-in polling places. Since most members, unfortunately, will not vote or even notice whether they've received a ballot in the mail, there are many ways for blank ballots to fall into dishonest hands. TDUers found that removing the process from under incumbent's stare to a member's own kitchen table reduced the fear of retribution and increased turnout. Most Teamster locals cover dozens of workplaces, often over a large area, so the hall is not necessarily near any particular workplace. As we mentioned in Chapter 4, the reasons for holding votes in the Union Hall are stronger for contract ratification than for officers' elections. In both cases, You want to remind members that they're all in this together rather than individuals making personal decisions. And since officers' jobs aren't on the line with a contract vote, members have less reason to fear reprisals for voting wrong. Reform through elections. Organizing comes first. A caucus striving to rebuild the union will probably decide to run for office at some point. They'll have the best chance of success in the election and in rebuilding the union if the election is part of ongoing organizing, not the caucus's only activity. If campaigning is part of building a movement for reform, then that movement can go on after the election, no matter who wins. Happily, involving a lot of people who see the effort as their own helps win the election, too. Thus, organizing is the key to any election. Ken Paff, TDU's national organizer, says that when he talks to rank-and-file reformers about their local election campaigns, he typically asks first, how many people are helping you? How many are passing out literature and talking to the campaign and getting other people to wear your campaign button or sticker? Questions about monitoring the vote count come second. While both challengers and incumbents will be concerned about the integrity of the election process, the first job of every campaign is to inspire members to vote for them in large numbers. The best monitoring cannot detect all possible election fraud without a huge investment of time and resources. A substantial vote in your favor is the best insurance. Herman Benson, former executive director of the Association for Union Democracy, always warned, you may need 60% to get elected. Exposing election fraud and demanding a rerun is a poor second to winning outright the first time. Even valid protests of violations may sound petty to many members, which can cost the protester votes in a rerun. Deciding when to protest an election that included violations is as much an organizing question as a legal one. Are the members mad about it? Do they feel their right to vote was infringed? Even when the rerun produces an election victory, the victors have often lost much of their mobilization to a drawn-out legal process. If your real purpose is not to win an election but to change the union, then your group can make important gains, win or lose. If a large minority of members vote for a more militant challenger, a winning incumbent will take pains to sound and hopefully act more militant after the vote. No matter who wins, teamwork built through campaigning will help prepare new leaders for after the election. It's the end of chapter 5.